Blog Talk Radio.
Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon, and tonight we present a discussion on the making and use of masks for magicians taking the roles of gods and goddesses in seasonal ceremonies. Our guest for this discussion will be Frater Issa, Magister of the Ubar Hermitage in Dallas, Texas, who has been making and using masks and ceremonies for some time. Following this discussion, we'll be joined by our second guest, B.J. Denny, the Purple Man, and the head of an iconoclastic purple party, a sort of a traveling Burning Man show, who staged a dramatic street version of William Blake's America Prophecy, which can be viewed on the Internet, and we'll read a little bit from Blake's prophecy. So, if you want to celebrate the 4th a couple of days late, join us, and we'll do some Blake and hang out the Gadsden flag. And, Frederica, you're with us.
I sure am, Poke.
Oh, good. Excellent. Thanks a lot, Michael. To get into this, we'll get to Brian in about 15-20 minutes. Anyway, I have been looking at all kinds of masks on the Internet, you know, even some ancient Phoenician ones and what have you, and I've even ordered a couple of books on mask making. Last week we were going to have you on and you were going to discuss this, but somehow or other with all that round robin that we had, we somehow missed you, man. So that we're going to catch up on that this week, because it's a fascinating subject. Now, with that in mind, you've been doing masks for seasonals for a while, as I imagine. Do you want to talk about that and tell us how you got started in that and where are you going with it?
Sure. So I actually got started with it the way that a lot of OTA stuff seems to start. It kind of started with Barden. So one of Barden's things is to maintain a completely separate persona for each aspect of your life. I don't remember what step it's in, but when I first encountered that about 3 or 4 years ago at this point, I decided to make masks for each of those personas that I would embody in the different parts of my life. And that seemed to sync with some things I'd read in a book, Postmodern Magic, where it's recommended that if you're walking down a street and you're afraid of somebody who's near you, you imagine yourself as a monster and you go through the visualizations of you becoming this monster. So it kind of tied together into that, and as we started working the seasonals, it just kind of fell into place. Also with the OTA, we traditionally take the name of a god or goddess as our order name, and it felt very natural to just go ahead and make it a fun arts and crafts thing to do after first degree initiations or whenever we had a slow meeting day, to work on masks for ourselves that are in the image of those gods and goddesses.
Yeah, and I've been doing masks for quite a while, and in fact, when you know, when back when we got started in the OTA, I did that priests. It's a sort of a cross between a crown and a Greek helmet, you know, that we use for the priest with the sun rays on the top, and then it's sort of you got a nosegay, and then you have the cheek plates, and it's just kind of like a Greek helmet. It's a mask, actually, and we've used that for the high priest, and we're still using it. And I keep it on the skeleton of King Solomon up next to the TV set in the living room when we're not using it for ceremonies. And then we had the priestess's mask, which was basically a headdress with a crescent moon on it and the Venus star. But we've always, you know, we've always had full masks for our demons, but we haven't had them. We haven't had these full masks for Baal, Astarte, and Tanit. And this is what I think we ought to get into. And one reason, you know, back when we got started, in 1970, we were all young and beautiful, and now, of course, we're not so young and we're not so beautiful, so that's a good reason to develop these masks. But they have a long tradition in the masks for people portraying the deities have a long tradition. The Egyptians did it. And the Egyptians did it. The Phoenicians did it. I've been looking at all kinds of Phoenician masks. Curiously enough, the Phoenicians, the eye holes in the Phoenician mask, I don't know if you've seen them, but they're like crescent moons turned upside down with the points pointing downward. This is the Phoenician style ceremonial mask. And I've made them out of paper mache before, and I made demon masks. I remember I made a Karanzan mask years ago, scared some poor gal with it so bad because the black light reflected in my eyes. And wearing this mask and really terrified this gal, but I don't know. I don't have that mask anymore. Well, that was a heck of a good mask, but it's long gone. And we use masks, of course, for Lotan, you know, for the Dragon of Chaos, and we have the skull mask for Mote, the Grim Reaper, the God of Death. But we have not yet done them formally, done these masks for Baal and Astarte and Tanit, which we certainly should do. Now, I want to ask you about how you fabricate. How do you fabricate ceremonial masks? Do you use mask blanks and work on those, or do you use latex, or do you? How do you go about it?
Well, with ours, we tend to use mask blanks or paper mache, depending on how involved it's going to be. If we're just having a bunch of members over to work on their own personal masks, we use mask blanks because we don't have the time for the paper mache. With a couple of my masks, I have used paper mache, though, because the paper mache stands up a little bit better, and you can do much larger masks with it.
Yeah, and of course, with one thing I learned, I got started in this back in college. I did all of the costumes for a production of William Shakespeare's Cymbeline, and I did it in first century style, which is almost never done. Most every time Cymbeline is done, they usually do an Elizabethan. They usually use Elizabethan costume, but it is set in the first century. So I did a barbarian style, and I got a chance to build a lot of helmets and masks and armor and stuff like this. And I found out that if you use paper mache, and then of course our sun mask, the priest mask, is paper mache, and you've got to have a wire armature. And I I ended up using coat hanger wire and bending, you know, bending it with pliers and better wire to use than coat hanger wire, but that's what I had and that's what I did. What kind of armature do you use on your paper mache?
We use chicken wire. So we have chicken wire that we cut up and we use. Because it has the grid's really useful.
Yeah, chicken wire is a lot easier to work with than coat hanger wire. I remember and also invariably if you use coat hanger wire it sooner or later it sticks out and makes you uncomfortable, you know, you can't have trouble covering it up. But I think the craftsmanship involved in all of this is a lot of fun and it engages people. And you know, one of the things, of course, I know this is an intimidating aspect of magic. A lot of people don't like having to build all the, you know, the equipment that we use, and they say, "Oh gosh, do I have to build all this stuff?" Well, you should, because you know, in the act of building it, you're making it magical. And this should especially apply to the masks. And the idea of the agents assuming the persona by putting on the mask is in a sense almost a magical act. One thing that one of our sister lodges. The Roebuck, which is the American branch of the clan of Tubal Cain, started off in this country. You know, it was called the Order of 1734. What they do is for their seasonals, they have whoever portrays the god or the goddess assumes the god form on the throne before the celebrants get there. And they meditate for a few hours before on assuming the god form before the celebrants even get there. And I think that I'm not saying we should do that necessarily, but I think the masks would kind of help. The masks would kind of help us get into really get into the god form. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I completely agree with you, and I think that there could be some merit to going through a consecration ritual for the masks themselves to get into that liminal space that is the home of that god, and work it kind of like a talisman.
That's a very good idea, Having a ritual to, you know, and the final stage is actually putting on the mask, and I think that possibly using the mirror, the soul door, or even the mirror in the triangle is a good idea. You know, one of the things that Frater Heracles came up with the other night, which almost knocked me over because he came up with this. He said, "Why don't we have Baal and Astarte, when they do the seasonals, wear the same lamens that they wear when we summon Baal and Astarte using the Goetia when we bring them up and summon them? We have these lamens." And they should wear them in the ceremony because they have received, you know, they were wearing these lamens when they received Baal and Astarte, and by wearing them in the ceremony, they are showing themselves and everybody else that yes, we have called forth the god and the goddess. That, along with the mask, I think could be part of the consecration process. And So this subject, by the way, do you have any books that you could recommend on masks? I've ordered a couple. Do you have any particular favorites that you could recommend to people in this mask process, mask building?
So typically, you know, I like to research all the things. With masks, though, I haven't done a lot of research. I've mostly just experimented. And I know that's weird coming from me, but it's something that I kind of had a – I felt like I could figure it out. So I looked at some blog posts in the beginning, children's crafts,
yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
And then I looked at theater props, and all of that was freely available online. Instructables had some really good examples.
Yeah.
So if someone wants to get started, just go do it.
I just ordered the Prop Maker's Handbook on masks, on theatrical masks on Amazon, and I ordered a beginning, you know, a book on beginning mask making. So I got two books coming, and I'll look them over, you know, when I get them, and you know, maybe give a follow up report on them, you know, when and see if they're, you know, if they live up to their expectations. So now. I recall when we were talking about this show, you know, the second half of it, or the second part of the show, we'll talk about William Blake's America Prophecy, and you told me that you had taken a course in Blake in school. You want to mention something about that?
Well, I might have been a little bit ambitious by saying that I have taken it, but it's been years since I was in school. So I took that class about 6 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I was trying to find my notes and I couldn't find them, but I did kind of review some of the subject matter. My degrees in literature, my focus was on epic. So of course I studied the romantics because they're awesome. And
yeah.
Blake is kind of the romantic par excellence. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, I just kind of briefly reviewed Peter Aykroyd's biography on Blake, which Fred Adams gave me and highly recommend. I think it was said, I think it's very good. I just kind of reviewed it before the show. We have, of course, right here, we have Blake's America of Prophecy and Europe of Prophecy, both of them from Dover Publications, and they were quite often printed together in the old days anyway. And so, BJ, are you with us?
Hey, Poe, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you loud and clear. Good.
Happy 1776.
Yeah. Well, happy 1793, I think, is when
that's right.
Anyway, which is about the time the French Revolution was winding up. Would you kind of talk about yourself a little bit? You know, tell us about the you know. Remember, I said that you and the Purple People were kind of a traveling Iron Man event or whatever. But
yeah.
You know, kind of extrapolate on that a little bit. Let us know what you're doing. Okay. Tell us.
Yeah, I think it was great you guys were talking about masks and postmodern magic, because that's exactly what we were doing on the East Coast when this whole America Prophecy thing started. I went through a red mask phase, a white mask phase, and a blue mask phase, and they all culminated in sort of this purple man mask that I wear now. You know, red and blue is purple, those classic colors together. So, yeah, we went through those phases, and, I moved to the East Coast, and one of the first things that I saw was the Rockefeller Center and this figure of Urizen. You know, I couldn't remember where exactly he was from, but this figure of the bearded man, you know, towering over this Promethean figure with a square and compass was one of the first things that I saw at the Rockefeller Center, and it just blew my mind. And I was like, I went into it, did some research, and I found Blake's America or Prophecy, and the whole thing kind of unraveled from there. It was just one thing after another, starting out with the blue phase. And oddly enough, you know, like right after we went and we called down the figure of Urizen, we called it the Fall of Urizen with my good friend Gage the Boon, who runs this kind of alchemical lab called the Spectrum in Bushwick or in Brooklyn now. After we did that, Hurricane Sandy happened, and there's all of this imagery and Blake's poem about the Atlantic deeps coming up and swallowing, you know, the shore and the horizon. And that's exactly what happened. And all this astrological stuff happened. And I mean, it was just, quite the journey. So all of this led naturally into the purple phase. I read about the so-called purple brotherhood in an old Rosicrucian tome called Mystic Americanism. And I kept seeing this figure of the purple man and Robert Anton Wilson's Illuminatus novel, for example. There's a figure of the purple sage. He's like this arch chaos magician, and purple just kept coming up. And I saw this figure of the purple man in a dream, kind of a DMT trip. And he's been with me ever since. And I've been driving around on this purple bus with my dear partner, Simon C. Pony, ever since. So yeah, it's a long, twisted story, but that's the short end of it, you know?
Well, that's fascinating. Now, what I'd like to know is, you did this sort of a street version, street version tableau of the American Prophecy. I remember, you sent me some clips of it. Now, this is ordinarily we would say, okay, where is this on YouTube? But it's not on YouTube. It's on another platform.
Yeah, it's on Vimeo. It's vimeo.com. You just look up BJ Dini, D-I-N-I, and the videos of America Prophecy 1-7 will come up. Some other stuff regarding, 2018 and that whole Saturn-Pluto configuration I keep talking about will come up there. And some other stuff that the Purple Party is doing now. You know, we actually just went on a cross-country trip with the Up to Us caravan, and we're trying to get some footage of when we took over Philadelphia City Hall and did a big middle pillar ritual there. So hopefully we can have some footage of that up pretty soon.
Yeah, sounds great. Now look, let's talk about Blake's American Prophecy here for a bit. Now it was published in 1794. Now of course that was a year after King Louis got his head chopped off, interestingly enough, Blake also did a big long, it was intended to be a much longer poem. In fact, he said it was going to be 6 books on the French Revolution, but he did the first part of it, and then his publisher said, I don't think I'm going to do it, and so he just put it aside. It's never been published, and I don't know, maybe somebody somewhere has published the first page of the French Revolution, but we don't know where whatever happened to it. Anyway, the American Prophecy was followed by Europe a Prophecy, and both these were usually printed together. And that's what
the figure of Urizen is the first plate on an Europe of Prophecy. That's where the Rockefeller Center got its archetype. Yeah.
Yeah, Urizen, by the way, look, the characters, people who do not know much about Blake, and you should, if you're into hermetics and you're into the Western tradition, you really should know about Blake, and I'm going to tell you how to find out about Blake really quick. On Thursday, May 9th, 2013, the Hermetic Hour with host Polk Runyon presented a discussion on the art and poetry of British 18th century mystic artist, philosopher, poet William Blake. was influenced by Milton's Paradise Lost, Swedenborg, Heaven and Hell, and Blake's subsequent influence on Crowley, Austin Spare, Fred Adams, and the modern Hermetic tradition. We'll delineate that. Okay, so we did a broadcast, and it's in the archives. Now, those of you who are listening, who really are interested in this, and if you're not, you should be, go to the Hermetic Hour website, and then get in the archives and go back to May 9th, so 2013, and listen to our show on William Blake. What I would like to do, just in order to kind of give everybody a feel for this, is read a little bit of this, the text. And by the way, Urizen and that famous painting. We got to call it a painting. It's in color, showing him holding the compass. You know, squatting down, holding the compass. And Urizen was Blake's version of Jehovah.
Exactly. And, I was hoping you were going to talk about this. Yes, yes.
That's right.
YHVH.
An orc. And that sounds like something out of Tolkien. And maybe Tolkien was influenced by this. Orc is Blake's is Blake's god of revolution.
Revolutionary whale, as it were.
That's orc. And so as we read, and also he has a goddess. Okay, has several goddesses. Blake was originally very, very much into even free love. He was a pagan. Blake was thoroughly a pagan. So let's read the prelude. The shadowy figure of Urthona stood before Red Orc when 14 suns had faintly journeyed o'er his dark abode. His food she brought in iron baskets, his drink in cups of iron. Crowned with a helmet and dark hair, the nameless female stood, a quiver with its burning stores, a bow like that of night. When pestilences shot from heaven, no other arms she need. Invulnerable though naked, save where the clouds roll round her lines, their awful folds in dark air, silent she stood as night. For never from her iron tongue could voice or sound arise, but dumb till that dread day, when Orc essayed his fierce embrace, dark virgin, said the hairy youth, thy father stern abhorred, rivets my tenfold chains while still on high my spirit soars. Sometimes an eagle screaming in the sky, sometimes a lion shaking upon the mountains, and sometimes a whale I lash the raging formless abyss, anon a serpent folding around the pillars of Urthona, and round thy dark limbs. On the Canadian wilds I fold, feeble my spirit folds. For chained beneath I rend these caverns, when thou bringest food I howl my joy, and my red eyes seek to behold thy face in vain. These clouds roll to and fro and hide thee from my sight. Oh boy. That's the prologue. Now we got to go. We got Urthona and being ravished by Orc. And Urthona represents the materialism. And Orc, of course, is the spirit.
Apparently,
of
he was a blacksmith spirit. It was represent earth and almost like a Kusor Tubal-Cain in your tradition.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Michael, you got anything to add to that?
No, I don't. I'm really enjoying listening. Thank you guys for letting me hang out.
Could I just say something about Urizen as a figure of Jehovah? Could I just say something about Urizen as a figure of Jehovah? Could I just say a little more about that?
Why don't you? Yeah. Okay. Well, you talk about it. Tell us about it.
Yeah. I mean, this whole poem. I mean, is and just like all of his prophetic works, is really about a revolution of perception. And that's why in all of the plates, there's all of this bursting forth of vines and vegetation and flowers out of this cold, dark, stony tomb that Urizen imprisons Orc in, you know, with his chains and everything. And, you know, I just want to say this idea of the American Revolution, it's a permanent, ongoing spiritual revolution. I mean, it's not something that was just a, you know, one physical act or declaration of independence. And it's an ongoing struggle against the forces of Albion or Urizen, which I think, you know, today has manifested in the sort of twin British manifestations of Zionism and Marxism. And I think that we're still kind of getting out from under these influences. And in this spiritual revolution, or I would like to say evolution, because revolution just is like a wheel kind of turning against itself. We want to move in a spiral, you know, not a circle. So I want to say spiritual evolution carried through, you know, through the works of Walt Whitman and, Allen Ginsberg, like I mentioned, the novels of Robert Anton Wilson, Genesis P. Orridge's Psychic Bible, that whole neo-pagan and cyberpunk revival, all the way up through Ken Wilber, you know, his integral system of philosophy, which is very uniquely American in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And I just want to say it's always a Western, it seems to be a Western movement, a Western expansion. And I always kind of felt like I was born in California, you know, that at the end of kind of manifest destiny, westward expansion of empire, so forth on this continent. I thought I was born in California for a reason, and I was always searching for, you know, a tradition that really, like, hit the nail on the head, kind of blended the neo-pagan tradition with the Hermetic tradition, but in a way that didn't evoke this constant, you know, Urizen, you know, figure of Yahweh or Jehovah. And when I hit on the OTA and I discovered L, which is something I chant actually intuitively in one of the America Prophecy videos. I just start saying LOL after the internet meme, you know, spelling LOL.
Yeah.
I got into this, your tradition with L being
the true source
and all of that.
Hang on,
yeah.
BJ. Look, we got, this is a kind of a touchy issue. It's
yeah.
a touchy issue because, quite frankly, Ezra, as you probably know, Ezra
mm-hmm.
and the Deuteronomists went to great lengths to take El, El Elyon, the Most High
mm-hmm.
God. And who was very obviously in Genesis and all the way up to Deuteronomy and Ezra, all the way up to that point, they did this all over in Babylon, and frankly, to tell you the truth, I think the Deuteronomists and Ezra and that gang. I think we're more Babylonian than Hebrew, to tell you the truth. But they moved heaven and earth and rewrote the Bible and made, you know, and stuck Yahweh in there everywhere they could.
Yeah, yeah.
And they got everybody, even the Samaritans, they even got the Samaritans to go along with it. And yet the Samaritans, every time they see Yahweh in their Bible, they pronounce it Shema. Did you know that?
Mm.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Shema Atah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm.
And that's
the original Tetragrammatron, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, on a 22-letter alphabet is Shema Atah. And every time the Samaritans see YHVH in the Bible, because that's the only Bible they have after Ezra got through messing with it, and they say Shema. Now, but this is a touchy thing. Now we can we can talk about it, but I don't want to. I think we have to be careful when we do talk about it. We got to be careful because it offends some people, but I appreciate your thoughts on it, and I do. But let's go down here a little bit and pick up some of the stuff in his prophecy, because Blake really was following the American Revolution. He did follow it, and he does reflect it here. Appear to the Americans upon the cloudy night, solemn heave the Atlantic waves between the gloomy nations, swelling, belching from its deeps, red clouds and raging fires. Albion is sick, America faints. Enraged, the zenith grew as human blood, shooting its veins all around the orbed heavens. Red rose the clouds from the Atlantic in vast wheels of blood, and in the red clouds rose a wonder o'er the Atlantic sea. Intense, naked, a human fire, fierce, glowing as the wedge of iron heated in a furnace, his terrible limbs were fire. With myriads of cloudy terrors, banners dark and towers, surrounded, heat but not light, went through the murky atmosphere. The King of England, looking westward, trembles at the vision. He didn't want to mention George by name. He was afraid to do that, and I don't blame him. But Michael, what do you think of this so far?
Well, I like it, and I think part of why Blake's not mentioning George by name is he's also trying to go with a mythic prophecy, so he doesn't want to pin it down to make it a mere allegory.
It becomes more archetypal that way, and he calls it Albion. There's Albion's angel and there's Albion's guardians, and the whole thing makes me think a lot about Enochian, the watchtowers and the Enochian scrying of the ethers. I have a feeling Blake was in touch with a lot of those same entities. I mean, when he talks about Oryk breaking through the five gates and the flames spraying through the five gates, I mean, that just screams Enochian to me. Does anybody know if he was familiar by any chance with Dee and Kelly's works? I know he read a lot of Renaissance magicians.
I have always, in fact, we mentioned this back when we did that broadcast that I referred to in the archives. We mentioned Blake's possible connection with Enochian. And it's the same. But whether or not Blake was actually had ever dipped into D. and Kelly, whether or not he had, it in many ways is the same current. It's the same spirit.
Yeah, for sure.
Because D. and Kelly, that's very the call of the 38ers is very apocalyptic and revolutionary, and the whole concept. Medime and her mother and whatever. There's so much of it. And Blake, even though Blake and his wife were devoted to each other, they believed in free love, and they even may have even had some orgies going,
I wouldn't doubt
not
it.
Not that
yeah.
I'm trying to promote that. let's be honest.
Of course not. We're all conservative here.
Blake was a swinger.
Yeah.
Okay, so
that's why he wrote such good poetry, just like Crowley.
There's a lot of relation. I would say there's a lot of similarity between Crowley and Blake. And I think Crowley was somewhat influenced by Blake. Sound, sound, my loud war trumpets and alarm my 13 angels. There's your 13 colonies. Loud howls the eternal wolf. The eternal lion lashes his tail. America is darkened, and my punishing demons terrified crouch howling before their caverns deep. Like skins dried in the wind, they cannot smite the wheat nor quench the fatness of the earth. They cannot smite with sorrows, nor subdue the plow and spade. They cannot wall the city, nor moat round the castles of princes. They cannot bring the stubbed oak to overgrow the hills. For terrible men stand on the shores, and their robes I see. Children take shelter from the lightnings. There stands Washington and Payne and Warren, with their foreheads reared toward the east, but clouds obscure my aged sight, a vision from afar. Sound, sound, my loud war trumpets, and alarm my 13 angels. Rending off his robe and throwing down his scepter in sight of Albion's guardian. And all the 13 angels rent off their robes to the hungry wind and threw their golden scepters down on the land of America. Indignant they descended, headlong from out of their heavenly heights, descending swift as fires, and over the land naked and flaming. Are their lineaments seen in the deep gloom by Washington and Payne and Warren? They stood, and the flame folded, roaring fierce within the pitchy night. You can see that I'm not reading the whole poem. I'm skipping around and reading an edited version of it, obviously, because this, it is rather long.
And can I just say that was one of the synchronicities. I mean, one of the many synchronicities. And this is magic that we were doing. This wasn't a show. You know, like I was reading in your Solomon's Magic book about how you approach ceremonial magic as a form of high drama or theater, and we were doing that in the beginning, but when we got all the elements into place, certain things happened astrologically and otherwise that just kind of showed us that we were really onto something. And one of those things was, with the 13 colonies and all the mention of the 13 governors and the 13 angels, I was born on April 13th, and I found out that was the same day that Thomas Jefferson was born on, for example. And, I did one of the shows on my birthday, and intuitively I just did this thing where I was Mars, I was Aries in my red mask and all this stuff. And I had, one of my favorite drag performers playing Saturn with a giant black mirror, and another person, my friend Gage, was Venus. And these were all revolving around each other. And I look deeper into the text and I find out that there's that whole section about Mars and the comets and the planets circling around the planet. Oh God, where is that? I need to find that. But that was just one of them. Then there was a grand sextile that happened, and there was a grand cardinal cross that happened. And if you look closely at one of the plates, just looking at the illustrations on the plates, you can see the Pleiades on one of these plates. You see the seven stars, and then the one at the bottom, and you see the star and the crescent, the plate with the snake, and all the children of America are riding the snake. You see the Pleiades on one side, you see the crescent moon and the star on the other, and that in itself is extremely prophetic. So happens in this book that I have, Mystic Americanism, there's this whole prophecy about the Pleiades. Could I just read a little section of that about the Pleiades?
Well,
in relation to the Pleiades.
Whoa, here. The Pleiades and Taurus, that's where the zodiac and the lunar zodiac originally started. Aries. We didn't start the zodiac in Aries until Alexander went, built that damn causeway over to Tyre because the high priest in the temple wouldn't let him come across and sacrifice to Heracles in the temple. They wouldn't allow that. They said, "Well, we'll come over to you, and we'll build an altar, and we'll let you sacrifice to Heracles on the beach, or Melkart." And Alexander was insulted, so he went and built a causeway over to Tyre, marched his troops over there, crucified 5,000 Phoenicians, and ever since then, the zodiac has started in Aries, but way back when, and you know,
so that's probably what the deeper meaning of what Blake was talking about with Mars being the center sun. Maybe that's what he was talking about there.
Yeah, but the lunar zodiac comes out of the Pleiades, and both zodiacs started the same time, about 22,000 years ago in Atlantis, and then 5,000 years after that, you know, again, it was the second age of Taurus. Okay, let's go and do a couple more of these, and then wrap this up.
Can I read that little section on the Pleiades? Sorry.
What? No.
Can I read that little section on the Pleiades, or do you want to skip that part?
Where is that section on the Pleiades? Are you looking at the Blake script?
I'm looking at the Mystic Americanism, the Rosicrucian book. It's just a little paragraph. It's really interesting for the future.
But it's not in the Blake poem, no.
Okay, I'll skip it then. That's fine.
Yeah. In the flames stood and viewed the armies, drawn out in the sky, Washington, Franklin, Payne, and Warren, Ellen Gates, and Lee, and heard the voice of Albion's angel give the thunderous command. The plagues, obedient to his voice, flew forth out of their clouds, falling upon America as a storm to cut them off. As a bright cut corn, as a blight cuts the tender corn when it begins to appear, dark is the heaven above and cold and hard the earth beneath. And as a plague, wind filled with insects cuts off man and beast, and as a sea overwhelms a land, in the day of an earthquake, fury, rage, madness, and a wind swept through America, and the red flames of Orc that folded roaring fierce around the angry shores, and the fierce rushing of the inhabitants together. The citizens of New York closed their books and locked their chests. The mariners of Boston dropped their anchors and unlaid. The scribe of Pennsylvania casts his pen upon the earth. The builder of Virginia throws his hammer down in fear. Then had America been lost, overwhelmed by the Atlantic, and the earth had lost another portion of the infinite. But all rushed together in the night in wrath and raging fire. And the red fires raged, the plagues recoiled, and then they rolled back with fury. And then concluding the last chapter. Over the hills, the vales, the cities, raged the red flames fierce. The heavens melted from the north to south. And Urizen, who sat above all the heavens, in thunders wrapped, emerging his leprous head from out his holy shrine, his ears in deluge piteous. Failing into the deep sublime, flagged with gray-browed snows, and thunderous visages his jealous wings waved over the deep. Weeping and dismal howling, woe, he dark descended howling, amid the smitten bands clothed in tears and trembling, shuddering cold. His stored snows he poured forth, and his icy magazines he opened on the deep. And on the Atlantic sea, white, shivering, leprous his limbs, all over white and hoary was his visage, weeping in dismal howlings before the stern Americans, hiding the demon red with clouds and cold mists from the earth, till angels and weak men 12 years should govern o'er the strong. And then their end should come when France received the demon's light. stiff shuddering shook the heavenly thrones. France, Spain, and Italy in terror viewed the hands of Albion. And the ancient guardians, fainting upon the elements, smitten with their own plagues, they slow advanced to shut the five gates of their law-built heaven. Filled with blasting fancies and with mildews of despair, with fierce disease and lust, unable to stem the fires of work. But the five gates were consumed, and their bolts and hinges melted, and the fierce flames burnt round the heavens and round the abodes of men. Oh boy! So that's the last one. I left out, of course, well over half of the poem here in the selections that we read, but I selected the ones that
the core ones.
Pretty much cut the story across.
Mm.
Now you understand that this poem was published in 1794. In 1793, that's when Louis got his head chopped off in the guillotine. Now, I have not, as I said, I haven't read Blake's French Revolution. I don't know what he was going to write. And whether or not he liked it, I would hope.
Well, he wasn't known to wear those red cap around, you know, town. What do they call it, the Phrygian cap?
What?
He was known to wear a red cap around town. I think the French Revolutionaries wore the red cap, the Phrygian cap, what was it called? So mm-hmm. He seemed to have a lot of sympathy for that.
Oh.
Yeah, but that symbol was also used by the Americans too.
Yeah,
it was that was a universal thing, and I love that thing. But the I think the bloodshed of the French Revolution horrified him.
Yeah,
I can't say that for certain because I can't hide it, but I seem to remember that being part of what held up that French Revolution work is that it was completely out of control.
Well, just like he was horrified to see what happened after the American Revolution with slavery, you know, because he wrote the poems about the chimney sweepers and there was a poem I think he wrote called The Little Black Boy that was celebrating blackness. And so he was extremely progressive and ahead of his time on a lot of things regarding that.
Oh yeah. I mean, he was really expecting America to free the slaves immediately after the revolution.
Yeah.
And then happened, it kind of crushed his ideals of what was happening.
And that's why I say it's important to view it as an ongoing, you know, revolution or evolution, and not just a singular act, you know.
Well, the French Revolution, I think the French Revolution was nothing that, as I said, I don't know what Blake's opinion of it was, but I would hope that he would realize that the horror of it and the injustice of it, it was nothing, was not something that I would think deserves to be promoted or excused or anything like that. And of course, it was the template, the French Revolution, as we all know, was the template for the later Bolshevik Revolution, which I have done a lot of research on, and I happen to know was, in its own way, even bloodier than the French Revolution and worse. And
financed by those good old British financiers and the Fabian Socialist Society. You know, the Fabian Society had their hands in financing that. So again, it goes back to Albion and Britain in a way.
Oh, of course they did. They did, and we had a lot of finance from people over here, like Rockefeller and people like that. There he is again,
the figure, right on the Rockefeller building.
Yeah.
Rockefeller and Rothschild,
right.
There we go.
I know, and that's another one. That's another one that we got to be careful talking about, although Rockefeller passed on, I'm not going to say like I'm supposed to say with Mohammed, peace be unto him. I won't say that. But anyway, anyway, this has been a fascinating discussion, and I want to encourage, you know, those listeners, especially you old time listeners. William Blake is really, really a significant part of our Western esoteric tradition. And
yes,
he is somebody to be savored, somebody to be studied, somebody to be and in fact, as I've told my Thelemic friends numerous times, I think William Blake's Marriage of Heaven and Hell, as far as I'm concerned, is superior to Crowley's Book of the Law.
I would wholeheartedly agree, and the Marriage of Heaven and Hell is very much responsible for the Purple Party Declaration of Independence, or Interdependence, I should say. I mean, that's the whole thing about the marriage of the red and the blue, the binary opposites, male and female, capitalism, socialism. It came directly out of that synthesis of the Marriage of Heaven and Hell. That was a huge influence, more than anything,
yeah,
more than Crowley, actually.
I think that the like people. If you want to have a mystic revolutionary that you can really have as your personal saint or whatever guru, you know, in the past, I would take Blake over Crowley. I think Blake outranks Crowley in that respect. Anyway. Thank you.
Although I have love for Master Therion, that's for sure. Lots of love to him and my OTO brothers and sisters.
Okay. Thank you both. Thank you, Frederica, and my best to your lovely wife, and thanks, BJ, and
thanks,
next
Pope,
week we'll be
having
back.
On.
Next week we'll be back, perhaps with another voice from the, you know, a rebroadcast in the past, or but pretty soon we're going to be reviewing William Mastil's latest book, Stories of Magic and Enchantment, which is published by Falcon, and we just got the copies today, so we can't review it next week. I don't read that fast, but it'll be coming up pretty soon. So. Anyway, thanks again, and we'll be back next week, same time. And meanwhile, good magic.